It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Democrats are gearing up for another run at Eastern Shore Congressman Andy Harris. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In past election cycles, the odds were always long against the man who unseated the more moderate Wayne Gilchrist in the 2008 GOP primary. 2 years later, he swept into office with a Republican tie brought in by the Tea Party. Since then, his district has been reconfigured to make it even more Republican. But many national analysts are now expecting a Democratic wave next year in reaction to the Trump administration. And this year, candidates are beginning to appear on the Democratic side, and one of them is Mike Pullen. He spent 24 years as an attorney for the Talbot County Council and is currently a member of Talbot Rising, a nonpartisan grassroots organization. But next year, he hopes to capture the Democratic nomination to challenge Harris. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to be able to sit with you this morning and talk about this. It's pretty exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. We're in the process of, we're in an exploratory phase at this point. I haven't filed yet officially, but we're hoping to put together an organization. And we believe that there is a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy, a lot of people want change from this administration. And we're looking forward to hopefully a good campaign.
Well, let me just refer to something I mentioned a moment ago. That is that at least in years past, ever since Congressman Harris was elected to the office, he's had a fairly sure thing. He's beaten certainly Democratic opponents. Ran across some stats the other day. District 1 has something like 223,000 Republicans, 176,000 Democrats, 88,000 independents, about 7,500 other affiliations. In short, looks like you have a long haul to go there, especially, I mean, you'd have to get to the independents, and that probably puts you over the top, but that's still a long haul to do. How do you overcome that kind of lopsided Republican representation in the district?
Well, I think voter turnout will be key. I think the message will obviously be key. I think that people are concerned about Washington. I think people are concerned about the dysfunction in Congress. I think people are concerned about our representative, his lack of accountability, his lack of substance on important issues that matter to people, his recent vote on the health care bill. I think people are engaged. I think people are enthusiastic. I think people are paying close attention. I think people are going to hold Representative Harris accountable, and I think that we can generate a great deal of turnout. I think that people are anxious for change, and that's what our campaign is going to be about.
Because if you go potentially across the Eastern Shore, see a lot of Trump signs, and they're still up, as a matter of fact. Do you think that represents then still some strong support for him? And obviously Andy Harris, or are you depending upon more votes coming from the Western Shore? I mean, how do you configure that out?
Well, we're still in the preliminary phase of our campaign, and the voter activation file, we haven't got that yet. So we don't have a specific plan in place at this point, but we will have that. I think that the President Trump has a core support that still supports him. We believe that those folks are going to be able to be persuadable at some point, perhaps not right now. As things move forward, we're hoping more for the independent vote. We're hoping to energize the Democrats. And we're hoping just for a large turnout. I think that when we get a large turnout, Democrats do better. No doubt we have a large deficit to overcome. But I believe in my view is that the message that we have will resonate with voters. I think that we are going to speak to concerns that voters have about health care, Medicare, Medicaid, those type of things, and issues that matter. So the environment, the Chesapeake Bay, sea level rise, those are the things that matter to the shore, matter to the First District.
Now, this is a district that you're going to be looking at midterms, which it's not impossible to take to make gains. We saw that from the Democrats in 2006. But it's white, it's conservative, it's older. It's not a presidential year, nonetheless. How do you appeal to those voters who look at Donald Trump and who, for instance, may look at Andy Harris and say, those are my people? I mean, we saw recently the election in Montana where Donald Trump is apparently still fairly popular. How do you deal with that? I mean, how do you break through with that?
Well, I think ultimately it's going to be up to the voters to decide. Our job is to give them a real choice. And a real decision and a viable alternative. We have a message. We have a view of how government should work. My job is to make that view known to the voters, to tell them what I believe that I can bring to the table, bring the experience that I have in problem solving with local government. I worked with the county council for 24 years before, and worked as 40 years for 40 years as a lawyer in Easton. So I bring some problem solving skills. I bring a vision of what democracy can be for the people of the First District as a true representative. My view is that the first order of business for a congressman is to actually listen to the people in the district, listen to what they want him to address, find solutions for those problems, and bring those solutions to the table in Congress and propose legislation that actually helps folks in their ordinary daily lives. I don't think that Congressman Harris does that. I believe that he's more ideologically driven by an agenda that really plays very, that has little to do with the district. For example, his recent vote on the health care bill, the second iteration, which was even harsher than the first, came out of a month-long deliberation, came out of Congress fully baked, very no public input, no public comment, no opportunity for public discussion, or not even a rating by the Congressional Budget Office before the House voted on it. And what that says to me is that the House does not care about the American public, that our representative does not care about what the people in this district think or what their opinions are. That's not how democracy works. We have to take back our government, and the first step is making our voices heard in Congress. And my message will be that I will listen to the people of the First District. I can represent their interests. That's what I've done for 40 years, is represent my client's interest, not my own. And that's what I'm good at, and that's what I have a passion for, and that's what I want to do for the people of the First District.
By the way, what did you make of the recent town hall with Congressman Harris? I know you were there. I happened to be there as well. How representative do you think that is of the district, and what kinds of things or issues do you see having driven the kind of turnout and obviously the response, which was fairly, well, I think, to say hostile, I suppose, is a good word, but certainly rowdy in terms of its response to that congressman. And was that? And I heard, you know, I've heard talked to some conservatives who felt it was disrespectful.
Well, democracy is sometimes a messy process, and when people are not being listened to, when people's voices are being ignored, when people are not being given a fair opportunity to express their views, people get angry and people get upset. And that's part of the process. And I think it's a symptom of the underlying lack of interest on Representative Harris's part to actually listen to people and to take their views into account. I don't think it was particularly disrespectful. I do think that it is part of the American process. Politics can be direct, blunt, and I think it needs to be. When we reach points where there is an obvious disconnect between a large segment of what people of the people's will and actions in Congress, people are going to be upset. And it's not just in the first district. It's all throughout the United States. I mean, this is not uncommon. This is actually very common now. And I think it's a healthy reaction to what we see in Congress. I think it's a very understandable reaction, and I think we're going to see more of it unless and until Congress becomes more responsive to the will of the American people.
Turning to health care for a moment, obviously the Affordable Care Act has certainly developed certain problems. We've seen some high premiums, although only in certain states. We've seen a lot of insurance companies pulling out of some of the markets. You only have, say, for instance, one, for instance, in a particular county. Obviously, I think you would want to continue the Affordable Care Act. What kinds of solutions are you thinking that you would like to see to shore up some of the shortcomings that, we're seeing within the ACA?
Well, I think you're correct. I mean, I do think that there are problems with the ACA that everyone is aware of, and I do think that the solution is attending to those problems. Those problems are actually a lot smaller and a lot more manageable than creating a whole brand new system. The disruption to the insurance markets, the disruption to the nationwide delivery of healthcare services is incalculable. For example, we have a proposed relocation of our hospital in Easton. One of the requirements for that to happen is that the hospital has to develop and propose and have approved a system for reimbursement. When you are removing and changing the entire reimbursement system, that throws that process into chaos. It is automatically going to delay it indefinitely at this point. And it's actually much more efficient, much more cost-effective, much simpler if you can simply deal with the problems that you know that you have. Healthcare is a very complicated issue, and it's in any large-scale effort like the ACA, there are predictable issues that are going to need to be resolved. That is exactly what Congress is designed to do as the framers intended it. I mean, the framers intended that there would be compromise, that there would be discussion, that there would be a democratic process where competing interests were brought to the table and considered fairly. That's the way that problems get solved. That's the way that this problem can be solved. It's not a one-side ideological solution fits all, and we throw out the ACA entirely and go to really what is a draconian elimination of health care for millions of people and throwing others into financial uncertainty, throwing people with pre-existing conditions into both financial and emotional uncertainty. And it's just not an acceptable way for government to operate, it's in my opinion.
I would take it you don't agree with the president who says that the ACA is done, it's collapsed, it's in a death spiral, and we hear that often from the GOP.
No, I don't agree with that. In Maryland, as a matter of fact, it works very well. And the data that showed that it worked very well was actually on the Department of Health and Human Services website, which was a federal agency. up until the new administration took office, and then very shortly thereafter, all of that data was removed. But the data still exists on the Department of Legislative Services website, which is a state website. And that data is very, very positive. As you know, Maryland did expand the Medicaid benefit, and if that is withdrawn, the projections are that the state will lose $2 billion a year in federal funding for health care. The effect of that is going to be either a massive reduction in service or a massive restructuring of how Maryland administers and deliver health care. Either one is completely unnecessary. I mean, the Affordable Care Act was working and is working in Maryland and does not need to be repealed or replaced. It can be tweaked and made to work even better.
One of the big issues that certainly drove Trump into the White House has been free trade agreements and free trade. Up until, as a matter of fact, Trump's candidacy, the Republican Party was actually the party of free trade. And now there's been a shift in talking about protecting jobs and getting fair trade agreements. Where are you on the issue of fair trade or free trade? And might you also ironically be maybe sliding a little more towards Trump in the sense of, well, wait a minute, maybe these things don't work as well as they did, such as NAFTA?
Well, that's a good question, Don. And it's one that I'm not I don't have. Let me say this. To the extent these free trade agreements have undermined American jobs, then I think that they need to be revisited and changed. I'm glad that the recent one in the Pacific was eliminated. That was a bad idea. I think that NAFTA has caused a great deal of disruption to American jobs. For example, we used to have a Black & Decker plant in Easton. It employed 2,400 people on really 24 hours a day originally. That plant, after NAFTA came in, that plant moved first to, I believe, North Carolina, and then right over the border from Brownsville, Texas. And the folks that work there earn on average $50 a week, and the price of the goods that Black & Decker manufactures hasn't been reduced. So in effect, what they've done is they've taken the good jobs from Easton, exported them to Mexico, paid the folks in Mexico barely a living wage, if you can call it that, and kept the price of the goods the same. And so what happens there? All of the money that was being distributed to the folks that were creating the products, the middle class, is now going to the corporate headquarters and being distributed that way and not to the middle class. The loss of jobs is obvious, and that's something that we need to address. So, yes, in terms of those free trade agreements, I think they need to be looked at, and we need to do what we have to do to protect the American middle class and the jobs that used to exist here in the country. We need to keep them and make those grow.
I want to turn to the environment and certainly the Chesapeake Bay restoration. The Trump administration tried to eliminate the Bay Restoration Funds. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. Certainly, and Andy Harris, for that matter, has said that he favors keeping them in. How do you balance the environment on the one hand and say something like agriculture or poultry on the other? There's been a longstanding conflict in terms of the poultry industry and the environment, certainly with environmentalists. How do you strike that balance?
Another good question. And one I'm not quite ready to answer because I don't know the arguments pro and con on either side.
What would be your principles? How would you approach it?
Well, I would approach that problem the same way that I approach every problem, which is first listening to both sides, getting a full and complete picture of the facts and the data and the effects of the decisions, the pros and the cons, learning what the options are, learning where there is middle ground, where there is opportunity to compromise and actually create something better than what either party may have originally sought. Working with both sides, trying to reach a solution that is acceptable to both. That's what I've done, and that's what I can do. That's my approach to problem solving. And if there are problems that are insolvable in terms of either people's expectations or what the minimum requirements that either side may insist on, and in those instances, you just have to make the call on your own if you're the decision maker, and try to implement it the best way you can, and be open to amendments if amendments are proposed that make sense, and get the job done.
But on the international front, we've seen a foreign policy, at least under the administration, which seems to be pulling back somewhat. A lot of emphasis on terrorism, for example. What do you make of that kind of foreign policy? How engaging do you think the country should be internationally? And particularly, obviously, we still have that simmering war going on in Afghanistan.
Well, I'm not sure that I fully understand the question.
What would be your approach? How engaged do you think the country should be as opposed to, say, the kind of approach that the Trump administration, which is sort of symbolized by America First?
Well, I think we should be engaged, but I think we should be engaged diplomatically. I think we should be engaged as a cooperative partner with other nations. I don't think that our military force is the tool for diplomacy. I don't think that our standing in the world is enhanced when we threaten and bully. And I don't think our military, I have the greatest respect. My family is a military family, and I've had ancestors in every war that this country has ever fought, going back to the Revolution. So I fully understand and respect the military. But I don't think that they are the proper tool for diplomatic solutions. I think that we need to use our economic standing in the world, our moral standing in the world, which I think we need to work on significantly. I do think that we need to be an example. I think that our immigration policy, for example, under this administration is exactly the wrong thing. I think it creates animosities and hatred it's completely unnecessary, and it's not what this country has stood for or should stand for. I think that it's morally indefensible to disallow children and families and refugees that are being bombed and killed in their country and threatened with to deny them access to this country is not what we're about. I think that we need to recapture our moral standing in the world. I do think that our approach should be a collaborative one, a cooperative one. I think we need to work with other nations, all nations, to build a better, more peaceful, and a more secure world.
Turning to what's been going on in Washington, we've been fixated on talk about impeachment, talk about obstruction of justice. We talk about connections with Russia, particularly the president's least campaign aides, for example. And if you were elected, you could be very well facing some kind of proceedings in the House. If it goes that far, what's your sense about that investigation? Do you see obstruction of justice? How are you assessing what you're hearing so far?
a good question. And if I am elected, and if I do sit in the House, I would be a part of that. So I'm not going to comment on my opinions. But what I will tell you is that I think that investigation has to be conducted thoroughly, extensively. Every reasonable lead needs to be pursued. And the American people need to be given the investigation needs to be pursued so that the American people have confidence that it has been conducted properly, fairly, and thoroughly. And the investigation needs to go where the facts lead it, without bias, intimidation, or concern about where that may lead. It needs to be conducted in a way that the American people have complete confidence that it has been done correctly, and the facts need to be brought out.
Are you concerned about the Russian interference, apparent Russian interference in the elections, and all these connections at least seem to have occurred between the Russians and the campaign? I mean, even the Russian ambassador, I guess it was, inside the Oval Office. What do you make of that connection?
Well, I rely on what the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded, and they've been unanimous that there was influence if not collaboration. I don't know that they've gone that far yet, but they are unanimous in their opinion that there was interference. And the extent of that and the connection, if any, with the campaign is yet to be determined, but it's clearly a matter of significant concern. It's a significant concern to me, and I think that the American people, we pride ourselves in this country on our history and the vision of our democracy as put in place by our founding fathers. It's not perfect, but it's the best form of government that had been developed at that time. The idea that individual liberty protected by a constitution that was written, the right to vote. The right to vote is probably one of the most significant and important bulwarks of our democracy. And when the election process is subject to interference by foreign nations that do not wish our country well, I think it's cause for serious concern. And I think it demands our full attention, and we've got to get to the bottom of whatever it is that happened, and the American people ultimately need a full disclosure.
How do you judge the competency of this administration?
I don't think the president is qualified to do the job, either by temperament, by background, or training. The concern that I have is that he does not appear to recognize that he needs to rely on others. He thinks, in my view, that he can do this job, and it's clear to me that he has made a number of missteps, a number of misjudgments. He fails to appreciate the significance, the complexity of the decisions that he's faced with. His comments about the intelligence community are simply, they speak for themselves, but I find it almost unbelievable that a president can think that the way he does vis-a-vis the intelligence community. He doesn't appear to have a very good grasp of the complexity of the work, the need for international diplomacy, I believe he has eliminated a lot of the funding for the State Department and eliminated most of the senior positions. And I'm not certain how many of those positions have been filled. But by doing that, you create a void in international diplomacy. And things don't stop in the world just because we don't have people filling those posts. What happens is the vacuum that's created gets filled by other players. And that is something that no country in our country can't afford and doesn't need. It's a completely self-inflicted wound that is just a reflection of, in my opinion, an incapable management, incompetent management.
I want to turn finally to back to local politics in terms of being able to win this seat. I ran across a quote from Heather Mazur, ran for governor at one point, and she says the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is still very old school and won't post cash for races with numbers like the first district shows on paper. So we'll take a candidate that can raise cash on his or her own and or fire up the grassroots. That's her assessment. She's been in politics. She has run. Is the Democratic Party going to be really behind you, or are you going to have to develop the cash and fire up grassroots?
Well, Don, I think that's an open question. We certainly have to do two things. We certainly have to raise the funds, and we certainly have to have the grassroots support. The question in my mind, and I think we're in a unique political environment this year, and we've seen that in a number of the races that have already occurred, these special elections. It's an open question in my mind about how much support will be thrown into the first district by the Democratic Party. Obviously, I'm hoping that we're going to be able to generate some enthusiasm and some grassroots support and some fundraising. My campaign is still in the exploratory phase, but we've started some fundraising, and I've got a crowd pack site that's up that is accepting pledges, not donations, but pledges. It's an open question. I think that we'll have to just leave that open for now and see how it develops.
We've been speaking with Mike Pullen. He is a potential candidate for Congress here in the 1st District to ultimately challenge perhaps Republican Congressman Andy Harris. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks very much, Don. Appreciate it.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Property taxes and landlords. Has Mayor Jake Day touched the third rail of Salisbury politics? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The mayor has proposed raising property taxes on rentals while lowering them on owner-occupied homes. That has raised the ire of landlords who say it is unfair to them and their renters. But Day says it's a way to encourage home ownership. Right now, rentals constitute around 70% of the housing stock in the city. If all this sounds familiar, those who follow Salisbury politics will know that this is not the first time a mayor and city officials have done battle with landlords. And someone who has followed this conflict for years is Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent and was for years with Salisbury Daily Times, where he saw many of these battles take place. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Don.
So what is going on here with this idea about raising some taxes on the landlords and maybe reducing a little on the homeowners? And the rationale being we want to encourage home ownership.
Right. The mayor's all about home ownership, increasing home ownership, single family home ownership in the town. So he presented a budget in which property taxes would be cut for residents, but would be increased on commercial properties and landlords. And no one had ever seen this in this area before. I guess they do it in Pocomoke and they do it in some towns in Maryland. But really, it's a very unique sort of tax structure. At first, people were like, wow, this is kind of cool. But then the landlords got more involved in what was going on. As businessmen, they're trying to protect their business. You completely understand that. Commercial realtors as well were very concerned about these increases because it can hamper deals that they have in progress. So there was a little bit of a backlash, and the council got very concerned, and they kind of pushed back on the mayor. So that's interesting in itself. Last year's budget, it seemed like they kind of laid down for the mayor. It was, you know, the first post-election budget. It was a pretty flat budget. This budget, in terms of spending this year, is pretty flat as well. But you've had this two-tier situation going on. So in the budget work sessions, since the mayor made his proposal, the council has gone back to pretty much a flat tax for residential homeowners and a smaller increase on landlords. They're going to meet on Monday, June 5th, or is it the 6th? 5th, 6th? They're meeting Monday
next
night.
Week, yes.
They're going to talk about this some more. I think they're going to make a decision about whether to do this. Now, the mayor has cautioned that if they roll back the tax hike on the landlords, they might have to raise taxes for everybody. So that could create a real hostile situation. The mayor might want to go back and recut the budget and cause a little bit of pain if that happens.
I can't imagine that if you raise taxes for everybody, particularly homeowners, who are the people who actually vote, that cannot be very popular. I mean, if they're forced to do that.
Right. If the council were to do that, that would be, you know, the council and the mayor would be certainly at odds on that. So it would be a matter of who the council is listening to the hardest. The homeowners haven't spoken yet because they're either going to get a tax cut or a flat tax situation. So they haven't been able to – they haven't really come out and voiced anything. But the landlords certainly have. And I have to give the landlords a lot of credit. They've done this in a much more reasonable way than they have in the past on some issues with 4-2. They've sort of taken a kind of a defeatist tone on things. Like they – like, oh, well, poor us. And, you know, we're just going to pass it on to the to our renters. So they're not hostile about it, but they're certainly talking, and I have to say they're more thoughtful in a lot of their arguments than they have been previously.
So as I was looking at this, according to the mayor, the increase that he's talking about in terms of the landlords, it's very small. It's at least of what he says, that they increase something like $3 or $36 perhaps a year, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the most there's all kinds of structure in this in terms of what the assessments are. But like at the most, you would pay about $8 more a month if you were a landlord. And the properties are divided into – you've got like the group houses where there are multiple units in one building. You have the single family home, and then you have like a duplex tenant situation. So they sort of assess taxes at the different kinds of unit situation. So the numbers are a little bit different with that. But basically a single family home that's assessed around $200,000 a year, which there aren't many of those. Most of them are assessed far less than that in the rental world. But it would be about $8 a month.
So is this really going to increase home ownership?
That's another thing. If you look in Salisbury, there are about, and I just learned this, I didn't know this, there are about 5,000 single-family homes in Salisbury, which I didn't really know. Of that percentage, only about 40% of those houses are rentals. So even though we have a 69.1% overall rental rate among the single-family homes, it's still a majority homeowner. I think that benefits the homeowner. It's just sort of an enticement. If you're a realtor and you're trying to make a deal and you're picking between Salisbury and Hebron, the fact that taxes are going down or have been capped or whatever might make that decision a little bit easier for you. There's some incentive, and I think it's just more of a tone thing than an actual dollar thing.
I mean, how do you assess, by the way, the situation with rentals? I mean, when I first got here, and this was a few years ago, we were talking about 4-2, which requires that you can't have any more than two unrelated people renting a home or place. How does that fit in with the efforts to rein in the expansion of rentals? I mean, because that was the big thing when I first got here about 10 years ago. Have the dynamics changed? Are we seeing a change in terms of the number of rentals that we're getting versus the percentage of, say, home owner occupied? I mean, what's the dynamic here? Because I've talked to some of the council people who've suggested, and Day himself suggests, that the dynamics of the past are not now operative.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that, you know, we were all very alarmed when that number went over 50% rentals. Everybody's like, oh, no, what's going to happen to Salisbury? You know, now we're at 69.1, and things might even be better. So there's like a comprehension of rentals. Certainly, we went through a recession where so many people lost their houses, and that really shook out lots of problems that were going on. But the city's just doing such a much better job with the landlord licensing with 4-2, and policing the rentals and doing the inspection. So I don't see rentals as the problem that they were. Maybe we've all gotten used to it. But yeah, in the neighborhoods, even with the SU students and stuff, it doesn't seem to be the grinding issue that it was.
Why do you, I mean, is it Why do you think that is?
I think better law. There's laws and there's policing? Enforcement. Yeah, and you know, and I think there's just better awareness, and I think everyone's trying very hard. I think the landlords are definitely trying very hard because they were on the wrong side of a bunch of issues, and they were vilified. And I don't think they, you know, you would think that they wouldn't care, but I don't think they like being villains. I think they want to be participants at the table. They certainly in the last exchanges where they spoke before the council, they were like, make us your partners, you know, get us involved. Some people on the council and in the city are like, well, we don't want you involved. We don't want your nose in our tent. But at the same time, they seem sincere about wanting to be a part of it, and they're invested in Salisbury more than anybody. I mean, they are truly invested in Salisbury.
So what do I make of – I saw a quote from Jake Day who said that landlords do not give back to the community in the same way homeowners do. I mean, that sounds like a slap in the face.
Well, in terms of like participation in events and people being involved, you know, sitting on the traffic commission and stuff like that, you want home ownership. Everyone agrees that that's the way to go, that the city's going to be more solid if we have single family homeowners in our community with their kids, you know, raising families, that's what Salisbury needs more of. And that's what it should be, as opposed to, you know, the giant dormitory for poor people and for SU students. So they want to do what they can to encourage it. And there's lots of little innovative programs that encourage single family home ownership. And that's what he wants to be known for. He wants to try to grow that. So you can't really blame him for that, because in theory, that's what makes communities more solid.
By the way, the low-key response by the landlords, do you think that has simply a response to the change or the approach that Jake Day is bringing to the mayor's offices, obviously, as opposed to his predecessor, Tim Ireton?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, you know, Jim, as much as he was at war with landlords, has actually been sympathetic with them through this exercise. Jim actually is on a tangent, he's more concerned about the sewer and water rate increases. There's about a 15% increase in this budget. Early on in the budget discussion, there was as much as a 30% increase. For some of these houses, the sewer and water charges are higher than the rent charges or the tax charges. And the problem with sewer and water is that bill comes every 3 months. People don't budget for it. They're not prepared. Suddenly they've got a $300 water bill. What are we going to do? And it's much more of a hardship than paying the taxes that might come out of their escrow. So Jim has been very partial to that. But it's been interesting to watch Jim almost be sympathetic to the landlords in this situation and not be in favor of a big tax increase for them. But I think he understands the effect on commercial real estate, because it's not just landlords. And I think he understands that the landlords, a lot of them are trying, and we don't want to do anything that keeps them from wanting to try.
I mean, that sounds like a sea change. I mean, because I was out following him around when he was running for mayor at one point, and he had nothing good to say about the landlords. He talked to the renters. I mean, they were like the enemy.
Yes, that's been his politics for a long time, and even in his own neighborhood that he's very aware of. There are some rental properties that are a problem. I don't know how many of them are owned by the corporate landlord structure, or as opposed to, you know, our mom died, so we're going to rent the house out till we figure out what we do with it, and they've got complete derelicts living in that house, that kind of situation. And those almost seem to be the more troublesome situations than the business-owned landlord buildings.
So take us back a little here. So give us a little history about this concern about rentals, because you mentioned a moment ago that at one point it popped over 50% and everybody got excited. When was that, and how did that develop? Because when I was watching the city council, particularly during the early years that I was here, there was a big battle over control of the city council. There were a lot of folks who didn't get on the city council who were very concerned about this. Jim Ireton, who had become mayor, was also concerned about this. What's the dynamic here? To give us a little history here.
My memory is it was like 1988 or 89 when it tipped over from 50%. And Robin Cockey was the city council president at the time, and he formed a task force. There was a lot of concern about it. Chamber was very concerned. But then after that, in the 90s, we had some construction of some large apartment building complexes in the city, and that threw the number way out. So they realized that, you know, if you're going to have like Ocean Isle over on Beekman Park Drive. That came later. But you've got like 1,100 units over there. They're all rentals. So that throws the number. There's no way you can compete that number with single-family homes anymore. But at the same time, you want that kind of development. That's a positive part of development for the eastern side of town. North part of town had some apartments built. So, you know, you've got the Oak Hills and the Parksides and the Parkwoods. They were here before, but you ended up with more of that kind of housing, which threw the number out. So I think they stopped focusing on the 50% number as opposed to the quality of the, you know, of the actual homes, and then started focusing on the problems with Newtown, where the big houses in Newtown were being split out into apartments. It was headed that way in the Pinehurst neighborhood. So they wanted to create programs and oversight that would keep those neighborhoods true single family homes.
So as the expansion of the home as a rental, is it slowed or stopped? Because one of the dynamics in terms of the pushback for particularly for 4-2 was this idea that you were getting all of these homes that would be turned into rentals, and you're moving into the Camden neighborhoods, that kind of thing,
right,
where you got a lot of opposition. Is that stopped?
I think it's stopped. I don't think it's is growing as fast. But also what's happened is the university stepped up, and they built these public-private things, what's it called, University Park and those
right.
places. So suddenly you had, you know, university students living on Florida Avenue and Smith Street. They're not there now. They're out in these apartment complexes. So that's been a benefit to a lot of the community, because you don't have some of the crazy college kids and all that stereotype that goes on there. But you have a different kind of renter down there now. So there's a lot of poor people, a lot of diversity people, certainly a big Latino population in that Florida Avenue area. So that's changed. The demographics there have changed a lot. But the university did its part. It got the kids off Florida Avenue and put them down near Fruitland, right, without building dormitories exactly. So they're not the problem in the neighborhood, but it's a whole different kind of demographic that might be a problem or might not be.
So, because one of the arguments I remember being heard in terms of opposing the restrictions, it was the idea that they had to provide rentals at least for people who were poor, who were low income. Is that still the case? I mean, how was this affecting, if they were, say, to raise the cost of, say, for instance, apartments and rentals, one would then think that it would ultimately affect then those people who are low income.
Yeah, and it will. I mean, I think any tax increase will be passed back on to the renters. The rental rates in town, it's expensive to rent a house in Salisbury. I'm stunned at how expensive it really is. It's hard to find a nice place for less than $1,000 a month. And I don't know about you, but that's about all I can afford. So it's a tough market out there, but it's a market. If there is any market, for sure, the rental industry shows what, you know, capitalism has going on in terms of supply and demand. And I think the high rental things make it better for people who might want to buy single-family homes in town. You know, they can convert them, perhaps, under 4-2. But I think what I'm seeing more and more is that people are starting to believe in Salisbury a little bit more, and they want to live in these neighborhoods. I have a friend who's about to buy a house on North Boulevard, and I keep telling them, like, do you really want to live on North Boulevard? Well, they're excited about it. So it's sort of a different kind of, you know, mentality in terms of the change in Salisbury.
And by the way, have we seen in a pickup, I mean, in terms of housing and new construction and housing prices? I mean, obviously, we've seen it nationally, at least overall anyway. There are some areas where that's not the case. What's the situation with Salisbury at this point?
What realtors are telling us is that inventory is very low. There's very few houses for sale. That prices are up slightly, but I guess there's still a lot of pushback from the recession. The prices haven't gone up as much as they would. But you would think that with inventory being so low that prices would be higher. Time on market is really low. Houses are turning very fast.
So, and by the way, in talking about the budget, because one of the things you alluded to was the idea that if for instance, they don't get the kind of revenue that they need from property taxes, because I understand, I think what their spending budget is something like, what, $58 million or something like that. Property tax revenue is around $26 million.
It's a flat budget.
Yeah. I mean, do they need – if they don't – if Day does not get what he wants, will there be a need to find other places to increase taxes? And is sewer and water one of them? Or, I mean, what is that?
It seems like sewer and water are settled. That they're not going to mess with that. Because that really is a quagmire when you go into there. There's so many different rates. because they different rates for different size of the properties and also where the properties are located. One of the secrets is that Salisbury provides sewer and water to some properties that are outside the town. They just charge double for that. So there's a lot of issues with that. So I don't see anything happening with the sewer and water. There was some discussion about trash fees, whether they would change those or not. Those are also higher than you would think, and that impacts people directly. It's a tough bill. But what the mayor has hinted at, and this is a week ago, and things change fast around here, but what he has hinted at is if the council does go through with a tax increase on everyone, not just the landlords, that he'll go back and he'll cut the budget to ensure that there won't be a tax increase. And he has said that not in a threatening way, but like, I'll go back and I'll have to make some cuts and it's going to hurt. And no one wants to do that. He, you know, he doesn't want to do that. So his philosophy certainly is to, you know, is to promote single family home ownership through a tax cut, punish landlords or make them more aware that that's not the way the city wants to go with this business, or make them pay more for having a business in the town, and then fund these things that he wants to fund. The council has talked about some of the things. He's got the amphitheater that he wants to fund over by the in the Riverwalk, which is it could be a replacement to Headquarters Live. Not really. There's been talk of an amphitheater there for 30 years. He wants to do the traffic circle at Carroll Street, which everyone loves to sort of snicker about. So there's some money there that could be cut, but I think he would cut other stuff because he wants to keep – like the Main Street program, he wants to keep things growing and changing and lots of new things. The Lemon Hill standpipe, people laugh about that. That's the old standpipe that's all rusted. They're going to clean that up and they're going to uplight it and make it look nice. I think that's positive. I think that's a good use of $140,000 or $240,000, whatever they're going to spend on it. But there are a lot of people who think, you know, we don't need that.
So, and by the way, talking about downtown and development, I mean, as I drive by, obviously it's all now torn up. You can't get in from Route 13. What is, when all the dust clears, is it going to look really any different?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what's?
Yeah, it's going to be, there's going to be the obvious stuff. The sidewalks are going to be different. Benches and lights, trash cans. There's going to be symmetry to everything that's in town. It's all going to look the same. But right now they're very close. They've done the underground work. They're putting in, they've had to do some sewer and water repairs there. They're doing some stuff to help with downtown flooding, which is a big issue. They've put in the high speed internet stuff that's been requested. So in that one block, that's been done and they're about to cover that up and they'll pave it very shortly. It should be in the next couple of weeks. That part will be done. Then they're going to take a break for the rest of the summer, and then they'll come back with phase two next fall. So that will be in September, and that'll be the next two blocks up. And this will happen every year for 6 years or whatever it is till they get up to the courthouse. But I think once they get up to that courthouse area, it'll look a lot different. It'll all be tied together, and that Main Street will be something very interesting. It'll be like a nice entrance way to the city from people come from the east.
Mm. So is Dave, do you think, really been able to move what he considers his vision forward?
I think he has. I think he's a little puzzled by the council pushing back on him here. I think they're starting to understand their roles a little bit better. They're also taking the calls from the landlords and the commercial realtors. Jake Day will entertain those people, but he's very firm in his opinions. He's not going to change. He knows that he sort of has the initiative on these things. That's what I see anyway. But he's going to keep adding things. He's determined to keep adding things to Salisbury that makes it better, that makes it more fun, that makes people want to come here. You know, Salisbury Festival coming back this weekend. So, you know, something like that, that's really hard to do. A big festival, all that planning, all those volunteers, it's really hard work. It's a lot easier not to do it, but it should be fun. I don't think it's going to be as big as it's been in the past, but it's going to be fun. And there's lots of these things that he wants to bring in. And you see that sort of infecting into the county a little bit with the county courthouse repairs. I think it's going to be so much better. That courthouse is going to look nice. They're going to uplight that. I think you're actually going to make like a nighttime destination out of the courthouse that you're going to want to go see this. That's what they want to do. They want to get things in town that people want to come see and participate in.
So now you're describing a relationship between the mayor and the council, which seems to be working fairly well. I mean, certainly in contrast to some of the conflicts we've seen in the past. I didn't ask you about this, but when I look at the county, there seems to be a different dynamic. We've obviously have this situation where I guess the county executive Bob Culver says he's going to challenge some of the changes in the budget. Beyond just the numbers issue, there's just a different dynamic, which I would not have expected.
We could do a whole other show on that.
That's true, but I thought since I saw it in the paper this week.
Yeah, the county's headed for Donnybrook on its budget, too. But just to close on the mayor and the council, it's interesting to see the council flexing its muscles, doing its job a little bit more, and not just working with the mayor, but doing the checks and balances thing. I think in the end, they support the mayor on all of his plans. And it's all going to work out, but it'll be interesting if they raise taxes to see how the mayor reacts and if that puts a gap in their relationship. At the time when he got wind of them not wanting to cut, wanting to reduce property tax increases on landlords, he went into their budget session, and I guess he's allowed to do this, but presented them with five different options to get to where they wanted to go if they wanted to do this. So rather than just leave it up to them, he got very involved. So the opposite is what happened here with County Executive Bob Culver and the County Council, where the County Council on its own, which it does under the charter, can go back and cut. They can't add to the County Executive spending. They can only cut. They went in, they cut $800,000 it was, enough to allow a tax cut. First time that I can't find anyone who remembers us ever having a tax cut in the county. And also $300,000 to fund some school projects that were requested at the last minute after the school board did its budget. So it made the county executive look bad because the council is going to award a tax cut, not him. And he sort of caught flat-footed, like, wait, I should be part of this party too. So he is challenging what they've done. He says that the budget is not in balance, which is a violation of the charter. He's also citing a charter amendment, which was just passed last fall, that has not been legislated yet. So there's kind of a mess there. Right. I think the lawyers are going to decide this. But he says there's going to be an announcement next week in terms of his next step. Maybe he'll get in with them and they'll do kumbaya. Or maybe he'll fight this. I don't really know what they're going to do.
I mean, this is not the first time that he's come in conflict with his council. And I remind everyone that these are conservative folks on the city, on the county council, and Culver himself. I mean, that seems odd to me. I mean, is it just a matter of personalities issues?
To me, it's totally personality. Yeah. And some people on the council would say he's not as conservative as you would think, and they cite the Warwick program that funds scholarships. They cite the alcohol at the Civic Center. Both things very much need in the county. I don't think those really are conservative liberal issues.
Yeah.
But they've tried to cite that. But I think it's just like a matter of who's driving the bus. I really do feel like that. There's some talk that county executive fired his finance director.
That's right.
No one really knows what went on there yet. It's a personnel thing, so it's hard for us to dig in and figure things out unless people come out and want to talk about it. Someone tried to tell me yesterday that maybe the county executive is a little bit crippled because of whatever happened with this, so it leaves the council with this opportunity to act. If you look at John Cannon's most recent quotes on this, he's like, we're not going to let the county executive politicize this. Really hostile, confrontational-type quotes. They haven't been in my paper yet. I haven't talked to him, so I'll be interested to see what he says, but the council doesn't show any interest in listening to what the county executive has to say about these cuts, going back on it, or wanting dialogue, or changing what they've done.
Sounds like a contrast between those two, between the two
ministries. Very much. Next week is going to be the city budget and the county budget. Yeah. Next week is going to be really interesting to watch.
Really interesting. Well, we'll keep in touch with you on that. Greg Bassett, he's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent, also obviously with the Salisbury Daily Times for many years. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.